Hello and welcome to School Must Go On. This time I'm talking to Supriya Atal. Supriya is Director of Studies at Bombay International School and has done extensive work for the IB curriculum. In this podcast episode, we are diving into India's thriving private education sector. I'm also learning a lot about international curriculum design, and of course, we are talking about how Supriya managed to get her teachers and her students through the pandemic. Plus, her outlook on how education is going to change. During Supriya's and my short chat after this podcast recording, Supriya and I both realized, be it in the United States, in Finland, in Denmark, Germany, or in India, education needs to change everywhere around the world, and the same ideas are in the air everywhere. What a time to be alive and work in education. I hope you'll enjoy this episode. Hello, Supriya.
Hi, Stefan.
It's a great pleasure to have some time to talk to you this week. To me, this is my highlight of the week, talk to someone that I don't know yet. And this time it's extremely special for me because we are right now sitting in two very different places. You are in India. I'm in Berlin in Germany. You're in Bombay right now, right?
That's right. That's right. Yes.
And you come today to this podcast, and there's a lot of topics I would love to talk to you about, because right now you are one of the leading directors of the Bombay International School. So you know a lot about international schools. You know how it's like to run a school. But also, you know a lot about India, naturally, because this is a place you grew up in and this is a place you work in. So next to international schools, I would love to talk and learn about India. And thirdly, through your career, you worked a lot on curriculum design. And this is something I'm particularly interested in because we all believe that curriculum might change in the future. And it's an extreme honor to talk to someone who's been designing curricula for a lot of their professional work time. So did I miss something? Is there another hat that you would wear today?
No, I think thank you so much for this very, very nice introduction and opportunity. And I think education, particularly schooling, is a much talked about topic, not only amongst educators, but also amongst other stakeholders. So I'm very, very delighted to be with you this evening. And I think it makes Germany and India just, you know, this podcast makes it seem so, you know, we've transcended boundaries. And I think that's the wonderful part about the digital age that we are now seeing in schooling.
Fantastic. Yeah. Maybe we can talk about India first and learn a little bit about more about the situation in India before the pandemic. Of course, the pandemic will be a topic. One thing that I find so amazing about the subcontinent of India is that it's a very young population. Yes. Roughly 28% of students are 14 years old of the population. 28% of the whole population are 14 years old or younger. So in Germany, I think we've got 12.5% of the population being in school, like being 18 years or younger. So we are not even half as young as India. And this must mean that education must be a gigantic topic in India, in politics, in civic engagement. Is this the case, actually?
I think that's true. With 260 million children in India at school, I think it's a really significant population which is at school. Schooling in India continues to be, I think, a very large chunk of schooling is still managed by the state across states in India. And I think that has its positives and negatives. But I think one huge challenge that arises out of that, state-managed system is that we have a lot of diversity in terms of regional preferences, linguistic preferences, cultures, and accountability frameworks vary, governance varies. And so quality education continues to be the most, I think, discussed issue across. Yes.
Wow. Yeah, for German listeners, I mean, there's certain things in India that we in Germany don't even like know as terms. Yeah, you've got tier one, tier two, tier three cities, a gigantic divide between the country and the city, and then also different social classes, lower income, middle income, upper income classes, a very high Gini coefficient. Can you take me back in time and can we understand if there was a time when education was very much centralized and very much the same around India, or was it always very different?
So I jumped into education almost by accident about 15 years ago. I came in from the corporate world, and this sector was nascent in Mumbai, which is where I've been for the last several years. Historically, I think the state has always tried to manage schooling in most states in India. And along the way, I think private players realized that there is a huge opportunity, because we saw very poor benchmarks and very poor quality education. And literacy in any case in India has been a problem. Literacy levels, the access has been a problem. Inclusive education has been. So we saw a change in the last 20 years. I don't know the exact percentage, but lots of private players have moved into education, and more so international education. So today we have about 150 IB diploma schools in India and about 500 schools which offer the Cambridge curriculum. Mm-hmm. So obviously the school population is much, much larger. But this is a reasonable, I think, number. These are reasonable numbers to indicate that slowly and steadily international education is seeping in through the private players, of course.
And this is more of a recent trend. This wasn't it wasn't like this 40 years ago. It's more a development of the last one or two decades.
Absolutely. In fact, in 2005, when I actually jumped into education from a very different sector, Mumbai had only three international schools. And now in 2021, the number is somewhere between maybe about 50. And growing. So you can see that exponential change, and Mumbai and Delhi do represent a large part of India because they're largely populated cities. Yeah.
Wow. So I must, I'm assuming before, when you first jumped into education, those very few international schools, they were mostly diplomats, internationals, expats, professionals working in corporates, international corporates. But now there must have been a shift in the upper class, middle class Indian families actually considering to take their child to an international school. Is that right?
That's right. In fact, in 2005, we had the American school, which at that time was only open for diplomats and American citizens. And we had two other schools which were extremely elitist and expensive, offering international education. And then slowly, as incomes increased in India, as standard of living went up, as exposure increased, as universities, international universities, we started seeing them promoting their education in India through university fairs and conferences. Slowly, parents started getting aware of the fact that if their children went through an international system, and I think the most popular curriculum continues to be the Cambridge curriculum in India, they saw greater opportunity. And the change has been rather rapid. I think if I just go back to Mumbai, from 3 to 50, in 15 years is fairly significant, given that, in other aspects, Mumbai hasn't changed. For example, we haven't improved our infrastructure too much. We are just about thinking about an underground tube system developed. It's taken us a while. We're still not ready. We just have one sea link to take us from one side to the other. We have very few flyovers. their health hasn't taken off. So if I compare education with, you know, health, infrastructure, I think education has been on a fast track.
So in Germany, we don't have a lot of private schools. The private sector is, I would say, in international standards, rather underdeveloped. The private schools you have are mostly reformist schools that are doing something different. Montessori, Waldorf. Every once in a while, there is an international school. Of course, those exist. But for the German listener, it would be great to understand a little bit more of the price points, for example, and the different categories of international schools one can find in India today. Because I believe it's a bit like, bad comparison here, like a car. You can buy an extremely expensive car. You can also buy a middle class car, right?
Absolutely. I think coming back to your first point, which compares Germany and India, I think there's a vast difference in the quality of education. I think probably the state schools in Germany offer literacy levels in maths, English, science, and so on, which was not the case in India, which provided a strong rationale for private players. Price points, so there are different categories of schools, as you mentioned. There are schools which have similar fees from kindergarten to 10, and then the fee structure changes in high school. And there are schools which have different fees in primary, in secondary, and high school. So let's take the one where we have discriminatory pricing. So typically a primary school which offers the international curriculum such as Cambridge curriculum or the primary years program in the IB, we see a price point of about 2.5 to 3 lakh rupees. And I think if you convert that, we are at about 70 rupees to the US dollar. So that would be the conversion. If you look at secondary school, it moves up to about 5 to 6 lakhs per annum. And high school, whether it is A levels or the IB diploma, there's a jump. Typically, it is about between 7 to 10 lakhs. And of course, you do have the American school, which sort of break the norm. They're extremely expensive. So broadly, that's the price range. So I would say much above $10,000 in high school, about 8 to 10,000 in the middle and secondary, and below that in primary. And of course, there are schools which don't discriminate price, like my current school where I work, Bombay International School. We have one fee from kindergarten to 10. We are owned by parents and they have maintained this. So we are 300,000 rupees. So it's fairly moderately priced up to 10. And then the fees only goes up in 11 and 12 for the IB diploma.
It's also interesting to hear that there's different private school ownership concepts. So yours is more like a cooperative, but then there's probably also the for-profit international school that belongs to a larger chain, that belongs to some sort of financial investor and so on. I guess that you can find everything in the market of international schools, yes?
That's right. And the cooperative models and the ones which are run by the United World Group, United World College Group, or the Aga Khan Group, those are few, the not-for-profit. Those are actually quite few now. Much of the market is dominated by, I think, the profit-making players. Yeah.
And you also mentioned the different curricula. So if I want to open up an international school, that's what I have to decide on, right? I have to decide, do I want to follow the Cambridge curriculum, which is a big export good of the UK? A lot of international schools are working with it, or the Swiss IB, or the American curriculum. How do you choose the curriculum if you are running the school, which is what you do?
There are three or four factors which play a role. One is, of course, international acceptance, but all the curriculums that you've mentioned have wide international acceptance all over the world. So the second one becomes price at which you can acquire these curriculums and price at which you can run it. Now, the acquisition price is not high. Of course, Cambridge is very low compared to the IB because, you know, if you have a certain number of students, they don't even charge you an annual fees. Whereas the IB has the annual fees and then they have the 5-year review fees. then you have to comply with certain professional development requirements. So I think the acquisition is not really a major consideration. It's what is it going to cost me to run a Cambridge school? What is it going to cost me to run an IB school? What is it going to cost me to run one which offers the American curriculum? I think the Cambridge model is economically extremely sort of attractive. For example, at our school, we have the Cambridge curriculum from grade 6 to 10. And we adopted it in the last 6 years. Prior to that, we had a blend of the national curriculum and the school's own organic curriculum. It is a very, very low cost curriculum. We don't pay any fees to Cambridge. We don't get audited by Cambridge every year. Of course, they do visit schools from time to time, but it's not from a review perspective. The professional development that they offer is very economically priced. It's like 100 sterling pounds for a workshop for 2.5-3 days. Mm-hmm. The assessment model is simple. The examination fees is about, let's say, about $800 US per student. That is for the board exam in grade 10 and grade 12. Mm-hmm. The teacher training is moderately priced. Resources are, you know, our teachers say it's idiot-proof. You know, the resources are so wide and so detailed and so granular. There is so much available on the Cambridge Support Hub that, you know, it's a very easy and a smooth transition. It's incredible how beautifully it is run. And despite the fact that they have such a large scale, you know, all over the world.
Wow. So what's other price drivers? Is it the teacher fees? Are they more expensive when you want to find IB teachers, or that's is it the right teaching material?
So the moment you then move to the IB, whether it's MYP, middle years program, or the IB diploma, which is the high school program, there's a huge jump in teacher salaries, in professional development. You need to have a retention strategy for your teachers. There has to be the salary hikes every 2 to 3 years have to be significant. Otherwise, go on and join other IB schools in India or even outside of India. The same is not true for teachers who teach the IGCSE or the middle school Cambridge curriculum. So I think it has to do with the fact that the IB teachers, you know, because the IB curriculum is extremely challenging, and particularly the middle school curriculum for IB is one where the teacher has to actually develop her own curriculum. It isn't so clearly defined. I think the quality of teachers, their level of education, their pedagogical training has to be at an advanced level. Else the school is not able to deliver quality, which creates problems, and there are parent complaints, and then, you know, it becomes like a vicious cycle. So with Cambridge, that's not, because it is a very doable, accessible curriculum.
That means Cambridge practically scripts every lesson that I would as a teacher have to hold, whereas IB, I actually have to create my own lesson plans for the whole 52 weeks of the school year. Interesting.
Absolutely. Wow. The scheme of work or the course outline in Cambridge is given to you, and it's so beautifully articulated. All you have to do is put it in context of your country, your city, your students, make it accessible to students with special needs. Whereas if you're teaching, if you're an MYP teacher, or you're an IB diploma teacher, or you're a PYP teacher in the IB, you have to start from scratch. And so you sort of need to be an inquirer. You have to be a teacher who has had some experience. Otherwise, it's a huge struggle. Yeah.
Now in your CV, there's a lot of work with the IB. And you're giving a lot of praise now to the Cambridge curriculum. Can you shine a bit more light on the IB and what's so beautiful about the IB?
So my heart actually is in the IB, because that is where I started my career in 2005. I didn't have formal teacher training back then. The curriculum has many layers, Stefan. So it actually doesn't even talk about physics, maths, unlike our national curriculum. it actually talks about the IB learner profile, and it actually defines the purpose of education as development of the IB learner profile. So basically working on student values and attributes such as inquiry, knowledge, curiosity, making them caring, sensitive, principled. So that's how it defines the purpose of education. And around this purpose, which is sort of defined in the curriculum model, they have put out something called approaches to teaching and learning. It's called the ATL. It's a real buzzword with any IB educator. And the approaches to teaching and learning has two parts. There are the approaches to learning skills. So they call these the 21st century skills, which is critical thinking, research, academic writing, self-regulation, communication. So again, it is the purpose of education is skill-based. And alongside that, the approaches to teaching defines the pedagogy. So they basically tell you that in order to develop the learner profile, in order to develop these skills in our students, we need to have pedagogy. So conceptual learning, inquiry-based learning, formative assessments, differentiated instruction, collaborative platforms, local context and global context. So while it is philosophically extremely seductive for a teacher because it's so exciting to read all of this, the how, the why is beautiful. The how, you know, the how is where the guidance, teachers need guidance.
Yeah. And can you tell us a little bit about the US curriculum? Because I would assume in the end, the US, it's got all the Ivy Leagues. It's got the whole Silicon Valley employer system. And who wouldn't want to study in the States for some time? Wouldn't it make sense to use a US-based curriculum to make everyone ready for Ivy League universities?
So we have explored the American curriculum at our current school, at my current school as well. And the number of schools which actually offer the American curriculum in Mumbai is quite small. It's actually only three. What we've understood of it is that up to grade 10, which is, I think in England, grade 10 is called grade 11 or something. So grade 10 in India is you do a lower prep and upper prep, which is sort of before primary. And then you do primary, middle, and then you do secondary. So grade 10 is the topmost part of your secondary school, and it's a board exam typically. The American curriculum does not have a board exam. They allow the school to create their own assessment model. However, you need to follow the Common Core standards, which means for English, maths, science, humanities, computer science, all your subjects, there are benchmarks given to you by the United States of America, which are called the Common Core Standards. So you have to meet those. But otherwise, it's an internal assessment program, which allows good schools a lot of autonomy and freedom to really drive contemporary education.
Nice.
And obviously, even in the US, there are some schools which are sort of considered feeders to the Ivy League because they do a great job. And then there are schools which, because schools have agency and the accountability is variable, not all schools are able to meet those standards. In India, we are, you know, very Asian mindset. So the moment there is a curriculum which does not have a top-up board exam at grade 10 or grade 12 level, parents will go, they will question the validity of that. And it's hard to break that belief system.
So if I talk about it in a very simplified way, the US Common Core-based curriculum is very, it doesn't have a lot of standards. It's not as standardized. You have the Cambridge curriculum, which is a bit of an autopilot for schools and teachers, and also a bit more of a more traditional way of understanding of subjects, skills, tests, and so on. And then there is the maybe the most future-proof curriculum, the IB, more based on principles and 21st century skills.
Absolutely.
Very cool. Thanks so much. That was an amazing deep dive on how international schools work. And of course, now I have the question, since the Cambridge curriculum might be a bit more pragmatic and you can understand that quickly, your kids, they learn the things they need. There's a job probably and an education coming afterwards, higher education. Would you say that the more pragmatist parents, they choose Cambridge, and the more liberal, free-thinking parents, they choose IB?
I would frame it slightly differently. I would say those who are very conscious of the price points and are not clear whether their children will study in India or outside of India, they probably play more cautious and go for the Cambridge curriculum, which is the IGCSE and the A-levels. The parents who have had a wider exposure and are keen that their children, or have decided that their children are going to leave the Indian borders for further education, they typically go in for the IB because they feel the IB is a better foundation. Though research doesn't necessarily show this, they feel that the IB is a better foundation for entry and admission to colleges in Canada, US, Europe, and so on. So it's a perception, and also the price point is significantly different.
Very interesting. Now, if we zoom out a little bit, not talking about the international school as an ecosystem in its own, but more as the role of the international school for the whole Indian education system, I've got a theory. Do you think that by providing high quality education in the international schools, you are actually uplifting the state-run education system as well?
We haven't seen much change in the state education system. It's almost as if, okay, the private players are doing well, taking care of certain segments of society. The state education system has remained fairly, you know, unlike the airline sector in India, where the private players came in and actually the state-owned airline had to be sold and closed, you know. This hasn't happened at all. So all the state schools continue to run with, you know, poor teacher quality, poor education. They continue to get funded by states. We haven't had a few, there are a few pockets of excellence where NGOs have come in and adopted some of these state schools, such as Muktangan. That's one major story where they've adopted a whole lot of state schools and run a decent program. But no, we haven't had that kind of pressure, no.
So how is the situation today? Do you have an ongoing trend of more international schools opening up, and they're getting bigger and bigger because more and more people realize if they can afford, this is the best opportunity for their children?
Absolutely, because with increasing incomes, better standard of living, reduction in poverty, we are seeing more and more private education come up. And I don't know if eventually, maybe it's going to take time, if there's going to be a shakeout in the state education system, but I don't see that happening soon.
And how about disruptive models in the private education sector that are completely changing the game when it comes to price points, because they work on a scalable level with a lot of online resources and stuff like this? And maybe this is the moment to talk about Byju's, which has been a company that I follow very closely. Is there a leapfrogging ahead of us, a game changer that will actually make private education available to the masses in India?
So the last 1 year was, a kind of pilot where, you know, everyone was forced into a different way of learning. While the Khan Academies and the Byju's and several other portals which came up provided good quality resources, good material, excellent platforms, easy to use. The research that was done by the Azim Premji Foundation, that's a really, interesting study on education in India, particularly in the last year. It doesn't show much movement, that research study. So it actually shows that people struggled with internet, with access. I'm talking about the macro picture in India. Access, they could not move from offline to online. They needed support. So it doesn't really show significant. But moving forward, probably you could be right that it could be a game changing. This could be game changing.
And you as a curriculum designer, how do you look at skills that enable people to get jobs right after school? I'm having one thing completely in mind. There is this company called Whitehead Junior in India. I think it was acquired by Byju's, and they're doing coding classes for kids. Mm-hmm. It's an idea I had for many years for German students too. And a couple of people have tried it on a profit and on a not-for-profit way, but it seems to never really take off. Mm-hmm. Differently in India, where it seems a lot of people have realized that you actually really have to look at the job opportunities out there when your children are in school, and maybe, only maybe, your children even don't need to go to university and they can start earning money in their early 20s already. Is this a big trend in India that you would say, yeah, it exists?
So we don't see this yet. There is many years ago, the government launched the VTIs, the Vocational Training Institutes, which after grade 10 put students into courses such as hotel management and hairdressing and baking and all of those, which allowed them to get jobs. Right after, grade 10 and then a little bit of vocational training. I don't think the quality of vocational training, again, because it was state-run, has been of a level where they were able to get employment. There are private training institutes, which probably feed certain segments. But this is not, unlike Australia, probably unlike other parts of the developed world, we don't see this as yet because the job opportunities don't give them enough income. So it's not the desired path for most.
And do you see a lot of civic pressure on curriculum changes in Germany? I'm always very sad that the curriculum and what we teach, there's no public discussion around it. It's a few people in the administration who make up their minds. And when they realize that maybe psychology is a good idea, then we include it in the curriculum. But the general public just doesn't get involved enough. The employers don't, the politicians not so much, and especially the parents and the teachers and the unions not so much. There's a few people in the administration who have the power to decide and they set the agenda. And I'm wondering, in a place like India, if there's more of a public, especially when people pay on their own, when they pay for the school, if there's more pressure on the update of the curriculum for the 21st century.
I think the most exciting part of the COVID year was the birth of the National Education Policy last year in India. After several years, the NEP, and I think it was a multi-stakeholder approach. A lot of virtual meetings happened between a whole lot of stakeholders. So, but there was no public debate. But I think they involved a range of stakeholders from different sections of society, from different types of schools, etc. And it has, very, very lofty aims. Purpose of education in India is to develop good human beings who are capable of rational thought, who can have compassion and empathy, who can display courage and resilience, and who have scientific temper and imagination. It doesn't even talk about content, which is fantastic. Wow. But these kind of, the IB also has these very amazing, philosophical underpinnings.
Yeah.
People are unsure how to interpret the National Education Policy, which has, been sent to every school in India. How do you interpret it? How do you translate it to action? How do you create a governance structure which can ensure that there is accountability? How do you monitor? How do you collect data to ensure that this happens? Because it is very philosophical. It's like a vision and a mission statement, not a lot of detailing.
Yeah. And it seems that the more you go down that route, the tougher the work of the teacher gets, the more you need to invest in teacher development. Because you're not just teaching by the textbook a bit of science and math.
Yeah. And I think one, so there is an organization in India called Adhyayan. It is definitely worth researching. They do a lot of interesting review work. So they have done several thousand school audit reviews. They are not for profit. And they spend about 7 to 10 days in schools. And they measure the schools. They measure how much a school meets a set of standards, quality standards with respect to teaching, curriculum, community partnerships, and so on. And I think... they have been talking to the government about, and I think that I know is happening, that they are talking about working with the government to improve quality of education, improve standards, because not only do they do a full audit and a review, they also give you recommendations, they also give teacher training and so on. So that is something which might, if everything works out, we may see some change in the quality of education. We may see elements of the national education policy in action, but then there's a lot of talk around it. And so India, we do a lot of talking around a lot of very exciting ideas, but where I think we go a little wrong is action, accountability, governance, all of those pieces.
Well, at least you dare to talk and dream. That's something that sometimes I miss in the German politics and administration, where that doesn't happen so much, and the dreamers are more among the students and the parents and the teachers. Talking about teachers, in Germany, we've got this gigantic teacher shortage. We are among the nations in the world that pay the highest salaries. You can earn, if you're in high school, if you're a high school teacher, you will earn more than $5,000 a month.
Wow.
And that's really like, that's kind of like you're a small manager in a startup, yeah? And that's kind of like your salary there. With all the freedom you have as a teacher, you've got autonomy, you don't really have a boss, you can practically do what you want in class, yeah? There's no lot of quality control either. And still, we have this gigantic teacher shortage. For years, we've had it, and it's only getting bigger. Even though the money is not the problem, people choose to do different jobs, but not become teachers. How is the situation in India?
Teacher supply is not an issue. Mm-hmm. However, trained teachers is the issue. So we have lots, like if a school advertises for teachers, we have a whole lot of applicants, private schools, obviously more than state schools. But when you actually go through the process of, you know, interviewing these teachers, you find that you're able to hire only about 10%. So there is interest, there is commitment, there is orientation towards being a teacher, but skills are not in place, dispositions are not in place, and teacher training is poor. Salaries continue to be low. Even in private schools, the starting salary would be in the range of $1,000-$1,200 a month. And then I think the peak would be, if I were just to average, it would be in the range of about $3,000. That would be sort of the peak. So it's not the most attractive job in India economically. And therefore, there are those who take to it because they want a second income, or they want to raise their kids, they're passionate about education. So, yeah, I mean, we have a different type of problem in India as gotcha. Opposed to Germany. But yes.
And talking about problems, the obvious elephant in the room when you talk about education these days is the pandemic.
Yes.
In Germany, some people now, they kind of say, we've got a lost Corona year for students, and let's make sure we're not going to have a lost Corona generation of students, because especially the ones in 10th grade who are finishing, or the ones in 12th or 13th grade who are finishing, they didn't have a good last year. They might not really know what to do next. They might just, you know, go lost, don't get a job, and so on and so on. So there's a lot of panic, and there's a lot of activism. How's the situation in India, and what would you think were some activities where you addressed the challenges pretty good?
I think the loss of learning dialogue is big in India. You know, it is big, definitely big in state schools, big even in private schools, because I think we all know that, you know, not all educators and students were able to access technology. Not all educators were able to deliver the blended learning program. They were not supported. So there's a lot of research done on that. Now, there are different estimates to the loss of learning. There are some schools which are reporting a loss of learning of 3 months, 3 to 4 months in the last 12. So, you know, that's fairly large, 10 to 15%. There are schools which did well and are reporting less. Nevertheless, I think mental health of high school students, secondary school students, even primary school students has been poor. Counselors have reported from schools that they have had to deal with very, very unusual behavioral issues, attendance issues, fatigue issues. So there's been a lot that has happened on the socio-emotional aspect, which has not been dealt with because people were not prepared for this crisis. So very few schools were able to handle it. Going forward, I think uncertainty looms, because we are not out of COVID. The tunnel is not clear yet. There is that whole insecurity about whether the May and June examinations in your grades 10, 12, etc. will happen. Will the results be poor? To what extent will various curriculum boards in the world adjust these results and grade thresholds to compensate for loss of learning? How will it impact admission? So these questions are large, and I think no one's addressing them. I mean, they are, you know, you put five teachers together or you put five parents together, or they're going to be talking about this. But there are no answers. It's a huge phase of uncertainty.
One thing I stumbled upon in my research about India was that there was a time when schools just moved outside into the open air and would do the classes under the sky. That's amazing. Did that work out well?
So those are called mohallas. That's a state initiative. That started only in November of 2020, where they found neighborhoods, they found volunteer teachers, and they ran classes in the open for about 7 to 8 hours a week. My understanding from the research done by Azim Premji Foundation is that it helped a little bit because the kids got an opportunity to interact in a more formal way with a teacher and their peers from the neighborhood. Parents felt a little better about, okay, my children are learning. But it was nowhere close to a solution. And very recent. It's just been about 4 months.
And then there's the whole online world, or let's say the whole media world. And I've researched that there's things that happen on TV. Of course, there's websites and apps, but there has also stuff been happening on WhatsApp. And I'm particularly interested in what India did on TV and on WhatsApp, because we all know that a lot of stuff happens on the internet. But WhatsApp, I found quite intriguing. And TV, of course, it's a channel. Yeah, it's there. You don't need Wi-Fi. TV is easier, accessible. Do you have some good best practices you could share from those channels?
I thought I might talk for a minute on how Bombay International School approached it, and then maybe go into this. So, like several schools, you know, we were caught completely unaware on 17th March. And, you know, other than the fact that everything had to shut down and nobody knew for how long, that's all that one knew. So the first quarter, which is right up to June of last year, I don't think was productive because, you know, it came as a shock. So teachers, parents, students, everyone was kind of not sure what to do. You were learning how to get onto digital platforms. You were exploring Microsoft Teams. You were exploring Zoom. You were looking at creating formal WhatsApp groups to transmit information. A whole lot of resources were being emailed, you know, from different educator groups. And everyone was kind of struggling. In the second half of 2020, which is from July to December, BIS took up mentoring and coaching for staff. So we actually invested in two instructional coaches of a very high caliber, and they worked individually with teachers. We have about 48 teachers who teach from grade 6 to 12 and visited their classrooms, online classrooms, and gave them various modes of support so that the learning loss was minimized and learning continued to be engaging. So within that, I mean, so we used Nearpod, we used PeerDeck, we used Canva, we used Quiz with the double Z. A whole range of various digital tools were adopted, Edpuzzle and a whole lot of things, which helped cope with 2020. Come January, February 21, despite everything, fatigue has set in for staff and students. So in fact, in the last 4 weeks, we've had to announce what we call a change of pace period. So in that change of pace, in every week, we've given one day off. So week one, a Monday off, week two, a Tuesday off. Additionally, the IB has removed 25% of the curriculum for the batch which is writing the exams in May and for the batch which is writing the exams in May of 2022. So with the workload cut, I think we've been able to sort of just have digital detox and things like that. One thing which has struck me, both as a teacher and a school leader, is that education was meant to be a social, social construct. And everyone talks about constructivism and the power of inquiry and all of that. And while the digital platform helped, it is hard to sustain it, beyond now, because there is, we've done an internal survey with our students and staff. There is craving for a physical classroom. There is hunger for teachers to interact with each other and collaborate. There is hunger for students to just chat with one another during class, after class. So all of those, you know, that deprivation is now, you know, one is seeing all of that.
That's so inspiring and interesting. In Germany, we've got a trend now, or there's a lot of political talk at least, that lost Corona year can't make for the lost Corona generation. So we have to actually squeeze in the students into tutoring schools in the afternoons. So the state might pay for private tutoring that exists. There's a tutoring, like in India, there's a cram school tutoring school ecosystem. And people are saying, maybe we cannot afford so much soccer, football, swimming, or whatever classes in the afternoon, because we need to make up for all the lost academic work. And the state is sponsoring extra private tutoring hours, which sounds to me very much 180 degrees opposed to what you are practicing now. And the question is an extra teaching time that we build into students' schedules to make up for the pandemic, is that realistic or not? What's your take on that?
So the word they're using here in India is academic regression. So not only have you lost whatever it is, whether it's 10%, 15%, but you've also lost the memory of the year before that, because the whole concept of prior knowledge, which you bring into a lesson, you know, that has gone, plus there is loss of learning. So I think, you know, bridging that is then going to eat into what you really want to teach in 21, 22. And it is disappointing. So while the IB has cut curriculum, at least for year 12, which is fantastic, there has been no cut from Cambridge whatsoever, not at all.
Wow. Wow.
So it has actually shocked me that neither our national boards in India, nor the IGCSE, nor some other curriculums in other parts have actually cut down. How does it really matter? In fact, if these boards had talked about reporting kids on resilience, on social competence, on autonomy, on self-efficacy, on, you know, things like that, you know, why didn't they talk about that as an additional component? Like maybe replace some 5 topics in mathematics, but get kids to write about this. I mean, yeah. At least it would have led to certain victories for teachers and students, and they would have felt rewarded for what they've really learned. So what they've really learned is uncared for. And everyone, the boards are still talking about maths, English, physics, science, chemistry, whatever. So,
yeah, you talked about educational regression and the two losses, the loss of new stuff to learn, new topic matter, and the loss of the things you've already learned before, which you started to forget. In Germany, there's one more topic that people talk about. It's that there's a certain group of students, more the ones that are not so well economically positioned. They're rather in the lower income bracket, and their families, their households are not very concerned about education. These kids also lost the ability to learn, like the fun in learning, the learning to learn thing, because they were just not trained anymore to learn new stuff and to enjoy that. Is that something that you see happening in your population as well?
I think so. I also have read about how children in primary, so children aged between 6 and 10 or 6 and 11 have the most deeply impacted because there you don't even have assessment to really measure what the loss is. But we know, for example, when students went for their admission tests for you know, lower prep, which is the start of primary, when they were observed for these admissions, they have demonstrated very different behavior from all the cohorts in the past. So something has changed very drastically for kids in that age group. I work with the slightly older kids. So, you know, they are talking about fatigue and, you know, relationship stress because they're not able to meet people and things like that. But I would think that below 11 lot, it's not so much academic learning. They seem to have we need to research more because they will need therapy. They will need support. It's not just academic loss. It's much more.
Yeah. Wow. So Priya, is there something you would like to talk more about? Something, a point you want to make?
I've spoken a lot on the aspects which are sort of, you know, worrying aspects. I just thought I might speak a little bit about some of the high points. Mm-hmm. And I know that there is already enough dialogue on hybrid learning, so I won't go too much into that. But the shakeout that has happened for private schools who have the resources to, you know, embed technology in learning has been big.
Wow.
And they seem, because of 12 months is a really long time. So at the end of 12 months, certain habits have gotten formulated for students, for parents, for teachers, for members of staff. I think some of these habits will stay. For example, our staff may request that 1 week in every month be an online week so that they can continue to travel a little bit and they have mobility and flexibility and they don't need to commute. Mumbai commute is usually really, really, I mean, we are a very, very densely populated big city. So they don't have to commute from home to school, something like that. Also, some advancements in technology, some softwares which were used by the maths teachers, the physics teachers, some platforms that were used, some assessment tools that were used. I think those might continue because teachers see meaning. They see, for example, adaptive learning platforms. We have a lot of software for that, easily available now, where teachers are able to see meaning in that adaptive assessment, because as humans, we are not able to create that. But, you know, through machines, we're able to. We may also find that students have formulated certain habits, particularly in the asynchronous space. We always struggled as a school with students self-regulating themselves for coursework, for projects, for tasks, for homework, meeting deadlines. I think now students, because they were forced to be at home and about 20-30% of the learning model has been asynchronous, they've gotten much more used to taking ownership and responsibility. And both Cambridge and IB do have compulsory components which are coursework based. So these are some of the good things, agility, resilience, the ability to cope with a crisis, more trust, though, of course, we haven't been able to meet each other, So culturally, while we are finding, probably we've shifted culturally because we've been working from home for a year. I think trust, because everybody is, going empathy, compassion. I think it has helped everyone reflect. So maybe culturally, I will see some of these things coming into the ecosystem. Or maybe that's my hope.
Yeah, amazing, Supriya. I'm blown away by the idea that teachers can have one remote week per month and that this can be integrated in the classroom. That's absolutely fantastic. And I think that would be a big leap for the attractiveness of the teacher job, because you could, fly to a beautiful island, work your morning hours and teach your children. And then, enjoy some extra time or just live with your parents for a while, move to the countryside. It sounds fantastic. And what I also understand from your vision is that you don't believe that there's such a big digital hangover after the pandemic. Yeah, some people, I don't know if they believe it or they just want to say something to grab some attention. They say, maybe we won't use Zoom or Microsoft Teams anymore because it's going to give us the jitters, the goosebumps, because we feel reminded of that pandemic time. You don't believe that's going to happen, do you?
No, I don't see a hangover from some very powerful tools. The ManageBack and Canva and Zoom and Microsoft Teams. And these were pretty awesome platforms, very easy to use and gave us a completely different way of looking at learning. I see the hangover coming from the absence of a socio-emotional support system, because that's where I see the hangover. Because families in India, you have joint families where, grandparents, parents, children live together. You also have nucleus families, and they've all gone through crisis. And it's hard to know what level of crisis, what level of stress, what level of domestic violence. We don't know. There's not enough data collected. I think that hangover will take. It's like they will need therapy for that, I think. They will need support on the mental health, the well-being. That's the piece that we will need to address.
One other thing you said that I love, I must point it out, is that you are drawing this picture of the future where we've got asynchronous learning, 30-40% of the student time or of the learning activity maybe. And on the other hand, you are, when I read your interviews, you are a very strong patron for school as a social event. You said that before in this podcast, learning is a social event. Yeah. And I love how you bring the two viewpoints together here, because sometimes people just tend to draw a black and white picture and they say, you can't automate school. It's not a factory. Kids can't just watch videos and do interactive exercises. It needs to be social and so on. And And others say, no, let's really lift up the whole all the possibilities of IT. And you're bringing it together so naturally, so smoothly, blending it into, yeah, what I also believe will be perfection in the end. Very, very nicely said. Thanks so much for this.
There are just two words I wanted to add to that: relationships and social capital. My own limited experience tells me that relationships and the development of social capital in schools is the difference between a good school and a great school. So the post-COVID era, going back to meaningful relationships, going back to building social capital by building collaborative networks in departments, interdepartments, between students, is really the phase that our school is looking forward to.
I'm a sociologist by education, and social capital was one of my most beloved topics. And there's a lot of research that shows that societies with a strong amount of social capital, they are just thriving. And sadly, over the past two decades, a lot of countries, also the United States, have lost a lot of social capital. And therefore, I think that's a very beautiful goal for schools to address, to lift up the society's social capital and put an emphasis on this.
Power structures pretty much destroy, now that you spoke about sociology, power structures destroy social capital. So yes. A democratically run cooperative model helps with that. Yeah.
Fantastic. Supriya Atal, this was absolutely amazing. I loved that you carved out a bit of your evening. I'm sure as the director of studies at the Mumbai International School, you've been extremely busy over the last year. And I'm so glad that we could have this cross-continental discussion here. I'm sending you a very warm hug from Berlin to Bombay.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I feel it's a privilege to have this opportunity. In the course of staying in touch with you and Anu and Xenia, I did a little bit of reading, and I think this opportunity helped open my mind, because I think we're all talking similar things, and I think we're all connected. That's what I'm getting, after I did go to your site as well, and I went through. There's one English podcast there. And I was thinking to myself that, there is everyone all over the world is talking similar things. And you're doing something so powerful by connecting all of them.
Fantastic. Yeah. I also, through this, the last hour we spoke, I also realized English is going to be the language I'm going to do this podcast in much more often. So I'll send you a link every once in a while when I've had a podcast that I think could be interesting for you. And maybe we'll do a part two in a year from now, discuss how your school has changed and how we're looking into the future. I'd also very much love that.
That sounds very exciting.
Supriya, thank you so much. I wish you a relaxing evening. Have a good night and a good rest of the week. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Stephen. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of School Must Go On. For updates and news, you can subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. If you'd like to send me ideas or comments, shoot me an email to podcast@sofatutor.com. I'm also happy to discuss and connect on Twitter and LinkedIn.